Okay, good morning. Welcome to our Canada Day Yarche Kala program. And the topic we're going to discuss today is how should Jews express our patriotism? The shiur is dedicated in the memory of Tzvi ben Moshe Reuven, brother of Nomi Greenberg. And I wanted to talk about this. I mean, it's an apropos time because it's Canada Day. It's Canada at 150. So maybe there's time, pause, to reflect on what exactly does it mean to be patriotic and what does it mean for us as Canadians to be patriotic right now. Before we, talk about the question, as stated in the title, how should Jews express our patriotism, I think we have to start with a little bit of a more fundamental question, maybe a little bit of a sharper question. Should Jews be patriotic at all, living under foreign rule? Is that a thing in Judaism? We're Jews, we have a set of beliefs, we have a set of guidelines. Certainly, I can speak for myself, not for everybody else. I feel a need to be patriotic. I don't know, someone noted to me this morning that the feelings of patriotism in Canada are a little bit different than in America. Maybe Rabbi Turchiner can confirm that or not. But yes, so it's a little bit, more of a salad bowl than a melting pot. But either way, I certainly feel a certain kind of identification with the country. But is that really borne out by our sources? If we look through our sources, is that something that we discover? So some have argued, and I listened to some shiurim about this, tried to read about it, that really this whole discussion, there's not a lot to say about it. It's very, because the whole idea of living under foreign rule in Judaism is basically bidyeved, right? Judaism is designed so that we live in our own country and we're sovereign over ourselves. And so the idea that we're somewhere else and we have to relate to this foreign rule is kind of bidyeved. It's after, it's not really a primary concern. But the more I researched this, the more I thought about it, at least in my humble opinion, I think there's quite a lot to say. I don't think we're going to finish everything. There's certainly not everything that I found to talk about today, but I want to sort of spell out something, sort of give a little bit of a sketch. So the goal will be, firstly, to answer the question, should Jews be patriotic at all? To build up a philosophical basis for Jewish patriotism. And then also to consider, how does this emerge practically? What do we do? Okay, so I'm patriotic, and so what? Should I have fireworks on Canada Day? Should I, if I'm American, eat a turkey on Thanksgiving? What should I, if you're in Canada, eat a turkey on Thanksgiving? It's not really exciting. But whatever it is, what should I do? How does that patriotism, whatever it is, how is it supposed to express itself? So first thing we have to do, if we're going to build up a philosophical kind of framework, is to define or ask the question, what is patriotism? What does that mean? We sort of have a fuzzy feeling about what that might mean. So I gave you here a clipping from an article from the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, which is great if you like to read about philosophical things. They have good summaries of lots of topics, and they're updated constantly. So this is part of what is written there about patriotism. And he writes that this is Igor Primorets, he writes that the standard dictionary definition is just love of one's country. But that has to be fleshed out a little bit, because what does that mean? So he quotes from this book, which apparently, allegedly, is still the only book-length discussion about patriotism in philosophy. I haven't confirmed that. That's what he said. That patriotism involves a special affection for one's country, a sense of personal identification with the country, special concern for the well-being of the country, and a willingness to sacrifice to promote the country's good. So I didn't put in the analysis here. There's more analysis that the author of the article puts in. But the takeaway from there is basically two things. One is that patriotism means a certain kind of relation, a feeling. It's an emotional feeling. I feel a sense of love. I feel a sense of identification. Whatever the values of the country are, I can identify with them. I can get behind them. I feel like that represents me. I want to be part of it. I feel a sense maybe of camaraderie with the other people that live in the country. And that feeling has to express itself. It moves out to action in some way, a willingness to sacrifice. We'll have to talk about exactly what those feelings are, but somehow this feeling of love, this certain kind of emotional relation, moves outward and causes me to do things. So that's more or less what the working definition of patriotism that I wanted to consider. Again, there's a feeling and a willingness to act on the basis of that feeling. Okay. So let's start to look through some earlier sources, some Makorot, and see if we can find any basis for this feeling of patriotism, for identifying a feeling of emotional kind of love and identification with the country that we live in. The first source, which is quoted often, and we'll see there's a whole package of sources here which come together, you find them together often, is this these psukim, which are not from Yirmiyahu, but rather Yirmiyahu. The context here is that Bnei Yisrael are going into Galut, and Yirmiyahu is telling them, don't think, you know, there are these false prophets that are saying nothing's going to happen, you'll be fine. There are false prophets saying you'll be, you know, you'll come back quickly, it's not going to be an issue. Yirmiyahu is telling them, no, you're going to go into exile now, and you will be there, and it's going to be a significant amount of time that you're going to be there. And so he's describing for them, how is a Jew supposed to act? How are you supposed to behave when you go into the society, when you go to Bavel? What should you do there? So he says, Koramar Hashem Tzvakot. I should mention that these are Shemos, so please don't throw them out. I'm happy to take care of them afterwards if you do not want to. But Koramar Hashem Tzvakot Elokei Yisrael, Lekol Hagola, Asher Higleiti Mirshalayim Bavela. So this is what God says. Banu Batim V'Shavu V'Natu Ganot V'Achlu Et Piryan. You should build houses and settle them, plant gardens and eat their fruit. You should get married and have children, etc. You should establish yourself in this country. Don't think that you're going to be coming out of there anytime soon. Feel established there. And then we have here the underlined part: V'dirshu at shalom ha'ir, asher higleiti etchem shama v'itpalu ba'adal Hashem ki b'shloma yiyelachem shalom. You should seek the peace of the city to which I've exiled you and pray to God on its behalf, because for in its peace, if the city has peace, you will have peace. If your city has peace, you will have peace. So that's what's quoted here. And here it sounds like there's some sort of relationship, some sort of prayer, some sort of engagement that the Jews who are in Bavel are having with Bavel. You have to daven for it, you have to pray for it, because your peace, your own livelihood is dependent on it. What exactly does that mean? So I brought a couple of different Perushim here. The Malbim is the outlier. Most of the Perushim follow the Metzudat David, but I brought the Malbim here just as a foil. The Malbim looks at this as more of a metaphysical kind of idea. There's a notion, I believe this is what he's referring to, which is mentioned by the Ramban and Chumash in several places, that if the outpouring, the divine outpouring of a country comes to it through an angel, comes to it through some sort of indirect channel from God. Israel is unique. Einei Hashem Elokecha Ba. God is constantly watching Israel, and so the sustenance for Israel is taken care of by God directly. But in other countries, there's sort of an indirect channel through which this flows. And the Malbim says, this is what this means. Dirshu et shalom ha'ir, ki tekablu shefa al yedei Bavel. Now that you're going to live in Bavel, your sustenance, your livelihood is not coming directly from God. It's coming through whatever channel Bavel receives it from. V'hem yikablu rishona. They're going to get it first. V'zeh shekatuv ki v'shloma yelechem shalom. That's what the pasuk means when it says, if there's peace for Bavel, if Bavel prospers, you will also be prosperous, because your sustenance, your livelihood, is dependent on their livelihood. So you should really, it's in your interest to figure out what's going to happen with Bavel, to pray for Bavel, because at some sort of metaphysical level, your survival, your ability to thrive, is dependent on Bavel's ability to thrive. The more standard, I don't know if it's standard, but the more standard view here is the Metzudat David, that this is really a case of just pragmatics. If you live in a country and the country is in turmoil, then your life is in turmoil. If you live somewhere and there's a war going on, then you, even if you're not party to the war, you didn't start the war, but you're stuck in the middle of a war zone. And that's going to be problematic for you. And therefore, and the Metzudat David says, this is what it means. Ki b'shloma, yiyeh lechem shalom, kshiyeh b'shalom, yiyeh gam lechem shalom. When there's peace in Bavel, you're going to be living there. Don't think that you're coming out of there quickly, and you should be concerned about its welfare, because if there's peace in Bavel, you're going to have peace too. Kema amar chachameinu zikroman libracha, havem itpalo b'shloma shel malchut. This is what Chazal said. We're going to look at it inside in a second. You should pray for the peace of the government. This is a pragmatic approach. If there's peace in Bavel, you will have peace, and therefore it's in your best interest to daven, to pray for the peace of Bavel. If we look at this actual Mishnah inside, we can get a better idea of what exactly is it that we're trying to prevent by praying on behalf of the kingdom, behalf of the government where we live. Rabbi Chanin Yaskana Kohanim Omer, source number 5, Havamit Palal Bishlomashal Malchut, She'il Malay Morah, Ishet Re'eu Chaim Blao. Rabbi Chanin Yaskana Kohanim said, you have to pray for the government, because if it was not for the fear of the government, each person would swallow up his fellow alive. And the Gemara comments on this. I mean, I think it's pretty clear already. This is the point. You have Madagim Shabiyam, according to Pasuk, explaining Pasuk from Chavkuk, if I'm not mistaken, Kol Hagadol Mechavero Boleya Et Chavero. Just like if you have fish in the sea, the bigger fish swallow the smaller fish. That's the natural order. Af Bnei Adam Ilmalei Morah Shel Malchut, Kol Hagadol Mechavero Boleya Et Chavero. So too with people, if it wasn't for the fear of the government, whoever is bigger or stronger than his fellow would swallow up his fellow. V'hainu D'tnan. This is what the Mishnah meant when it said, you have to pray for the welfare of the government. So what do we have here? If we take a step back, this is a purely pragmatic approach. Right, I don't want, this is, you know, I mean, I want to say this is classic Hobbesian social contract theory, but this is far before Hobbes, this is far before any of these things. But this is the notion of the state of nature. If you leave people without a government to impose fear on them of breaking the rules, of doing whatever they want, then there's total anarchy, and whoever is more powerful is going to, you know, exert that power over whoever is weaker, and you're going to just have chaos. So there's value in having a government because the government keeps things in check and they keep things from going crazy. And therefore, you should be happy, you should pray for the peace of the government where you live, because if they are able to maintain order, if they're strong and they keep people deterred from doing violence, that's going to be in your best interest as well. That, if we package all of this together, I didn't put it on the sheet, but the Avudraham, which is, I think, the earliest source we have for praying for the government in Shul, takes all these sources, he takes the Pasuk in Yirmiyah, and he takes the Mishnah, and he takes the Gemara, and he puts it all together and says, therefore, in Shul, we should pray for the government. When do you do this? You're supposed to pray for the government. It's not in your whatever. When do you do this? You do it in Shul. Yeah.
It's only if the government is a benevolent government, right? It's a dictatorship, or inherently corrupt.
I mean, so you have to weigh it out. If it's a situation where people are unsafe, where this is not happening, the government is not keeping people safe on a practical level, so then perhaps this would fall away. But even if you have a government which is not what we would call a moral government, which doesn't fit to a moral standard that you think is right, they could still be successful in keeping people in line. So that might still exist there, and you may still want to pray for it, even if you don't. Even if you don't agree with the government's policies. So this is one package of sources, this kind of pragmatic approach, but in terms of what we defined at the beginning, do I have to identify with this government? Do I have to feel love for it?
Just going back to the, mm-hmm. which government we like and we're willing to daven for. So the Mahram Padua in Italy, in the 16th century, defends the practice of davening and holding the sacred Torah in shul and davening for the government, and he says they did it in the time of the second Beis HaMikdash. I don't think he means the Jewish government. He's talking about the government under whom we live. So pick your poison.
Right. So any government's better than no government. It's really what.
Right. That's more. I mean, again, if it's not working, if there's a government where it's totally not happening, so that's a different issue. Right, so this is, but in terms of patriotism, if we're going to define patriotism as my love, my feelings of identification, I don't have to identify with Soviet Russia if I'm living, so wherever I'm living, I just have to be, you know, I just have to have hakar tata, this is not, whatever, that's a little political, but I just have to have recognition that they're keeping order, and that's not necessarily patriotism, that's called, you know, that's not called love of the country, it's called love of myself. I don't want to be in danger, and therefore I value praying for the government so that I'm not in danger. So let's see if we can go a drop further. Is there anything else? I don't think this yet qualifies as patriotism at all. Is there anything else we can find? So something else which we see, which I saw quoted in a number of places, is this Gemara, source number 7, the Gemara from Psachim, which actually I believe is also even more obscure source, a Pasuk in Chumash. So source number 7, the Gemara says, "Atida Mitzrayim shetavid doron l'Mashiach." In the future, Egypt, in the times of the Mashiach, will send some sort of gift. Kisavur eino mekabel mehem, and the Mashiach will say, "I'm not taking this gift from the Egyptians. The Egyptians treated the Jews terribly." God will tell the Mashiach, "Amar lo Kadosh Baruch Hu l'Mashiach kabel mehem. Achsanya asu lebanai b'mitzrayim. Miyad ya'atiyu chashmanim minei mitzrayim. So you should accept it from them because they provided lodgings. They provided a place to live for my children while they're in Egypt. And immediately they translated, I should have changed it, but I pulled the translation from somewhere, nobles shall come out of Egypt. The idea, instead of nobles, chashmanim, it's talking about gifts. That's how the Rashbam interprets that. Their gifts will come out of Egypt. It will be appropriate to accept the gifts of Egypt. And we see the same kind of sentiment, I think, according to Rashi at least, expressed in the Chumash. We're talking here about different nations, whether or not they're allowed to convert and eventually marry into the greater Jewish people, and Ammon and Moab are excluded. And afterwards, the Torah tells us, Lo tete'ev Edomi, you can't reject an Edomite if he wants to come and join the Jewish people, ki achechahu, because he's your brother. You cannot reject the Egyptian because you were a soldier, you were a stranger in his land. And Rashi says, and therefore, banim asher yuvaldu lehem, dor shlishi yavo lehem b'kal Hashem. So the children who are born to them in the third generation can enter the community. Lo titaev mitzri, so Rashi says, mikol vachol, you shouldn't totally reject him. He can't be totally rejected forever. There's a few generations in between. Afal pi shezarku even though they threw your male sons into the river, why shouldn't I reject them? Because in difficult times, they provided you with somewhere to live. So this is the source that we see. And at this point, really, we're talking about Hakara Tatova. You have to recognize the good. In other words, even though the Egyptians were terrible, they treated us terribly, they enslaved us. It was something where God had to come and pull us out of the situation because it was so horrible. Nevertheless, we're required to show some amount of recognition of the good, and we have to treat them differently than we would treat somebody else. We have to treat them in a special way because of the good that I recognize that they did. So the question is this now patriotism? Are we now saying, I feel like I'm identifying, I feel like I love the Egyptians, and I still don't think this is patriotism. I still don't think we're talking here about love, about identification. I think this is basically a Jewish requirement to do Hakara Tatova. We have to recognize good that someone did for me. Even if they did a whole slew of horrible things afterwards and before, if someone did an earnestly good thing for us, we have to recognize that. That's part of our responsibilities as a Jew, to do Hakara Tatova. But that doesn't mean I have to identify with Egyptian mentality. I don't have to identify with Egyptian philosophy. I don't have to say that they did good things. I think it was valuable. I just have to say they did something nice for me, and this is something we have to recognize later, or even at the time, but in retrospect. So again, I don't think this would be called patriotism. But what we have so far is a recognition of the government, the importance of government from a certain self-serving perspective. We want peace, so we want the government, the place we live in, to have peace. We also have a notion of Hakara Tatova. Someone does good things for you, you have to recognize that they did, and you may even treat them a little bit differently. But is there some sort of basis for moving beyond that? Is there some sort of basis for saying, I value, I identify with the place where I live, and therefore, we'll have to talk about what that means. But is there some sort of idea like that? Do we find some sort of basis? Sort of clear questions, comments, concerns? Okay. So this question, I think, again, this is not something I saw somewhere else, so you're welcome to throw it out the window. But the way this debate about whether or not, or at what point do we feel these feelings of emotion, some sort of identification with the country that we live in, may be part of the debate, part of the discussion in this story in source number 10, the story in the Gemara in Masechet Shabbat, which many may be familiar with. Because of it's also included, I cut it out here because it's not the focus, is the story of Reb Shimon Bar Yochai when he has to hide in the cave with his son. He's hiding in the cave and he's taken care of miraculously. That's in the middle part of the story, but I'm interested in what comes before and after. So what happens in this story of Reb Shimon Bar Yochai and Reb Yehuda ben Geri and Reb Yossi? The background here is, the Gemara had mentioned that Reb Yehuda ben Gerim, the son, who's literally the son of converts, he was called the Rosh HaMedabrim, the first one to speak, the Rosh HaMedabrim b'kol makom. He's always the first one to speak. So the Gemara takes a tangent and says, well, why is it? Why is he called the first one to speak? Why did that happen? It sounds like, the implication is this was a position, it was a title, but also a position. He would always be the first one to speak if there was a gathering. Why did this come about? Because of this event, this story that happened once. The Yatveh, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Shimon. The Yativ Yehuda ben Gerim Gabayu. Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yossi, and Rabbi Shimon were sitting together, and Rabbi Yehuda ben Gerim was there also. Right. It's Rabbi Yehuda was called the Rosh HaMedaber, not Rabbi Yehuda ben Gerim. My mistake. Patach Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda said, Kama na'im ma'asehem shel umazu. How great are the actions of this nation? How great are their works? Tiknu shvakim, tiknu gesharim, tiknu merchatzaot. They made marketplaces, and they made bridges, and they made bathhouses. Rabbi Yossi Shatak, he didn't say anything. Na nerashbi, it doesn't say he said, he responded. It was like a challenging kind of response. Ve'amar, kol ma shetiknu lo tiknu elo letzorach atzman. Whatever they only made for themselves. Tiknu shvakim lehoshiv behen zonot, merchatzaot le'aden behen atzman, gesharim litolman mechas. They didn't do this for anybody but themselves. They built all of these things. They built the marketplaces to put prostitutes there. They built the bathhouses for their own purposes so that they could, you know, they could enjoy themselves. They could make themselves feel good in the bathhouses. And they made bridges so that they could take taxes. They could take tolls from the bridges and enrich themselves. Okay, halach Rabbi Yehuda ben Gerim v'siper divrehem. So Rabbi Yehuda ben Gerim went and told their, and it ended up being the case, it's not exactly clear, some people say he told someone else and someone overheard, some people say he was the tell, whatever exactly, whatever happened. V'nishmu l'malchut, the Romans found out what happened. Amru Rabbi Yehuda she'ila yitaleh. So the Roman decree was, Rabbi Yehuda, who complimented us, should be raised up, his position should be raised up, and therefore he became Rosh HaMedabrim, he was given this position. Rabbi Yossi Sheshatak Yigla Litzipori, Rabbi Yossi, who said nothing, should be exiled to Tzipori, and Shimon Shigina Yiharig, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, who said a bad thing, who insulted the government, should be killed. And then, after this comes the story where he runs away, first to his Beis Medrash, then to a cave, and he's stuck in the cave, and he comes out of the cave, back into the cave, he has this whole story. Then, eventually, he comes out, the decree is cancelled, he has this, some sort of skin illness, which is treated. Great. Afterwards, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai says, Hov itrachish nisa, Ezel itkin milta. Once he said, now that a miracle has happened to me and I've been saved, let me go and fix something. Let me go and contribute in some way to the society around me. Dichtiv, we see a precedent for this from Yaakov Avinu. Yaakov has his battle with the angel, with Saro Shel Esav, and he comes out, and by the time he gets to Shechem, Vayavo Yaakov Shalem, he gets to Shechem, he's complete. V'amarav Shalem Begufo, Shalem B'mamono, Shalem B'Torato. He's complete in his body, in his money, in his Torah, he's totally complete. He makes it back into Israel, he has this battle, he has a battle with Lavan, he has a battle with Saro Shel Esav, he makes it back, he's okay, this is his miracle, Itrachesh Nisa. And then it tells us, the Torah tells us, Vayichanet Pnei Hayir, that he control whatever he dwells. It's not exactly clear. Dwells on this in the city or al pnei yir in the face of the city. The Gemara takes the language here, which is a little bit strange. It also says he already arrived there. So why does it say vaychan? And assumes that he made some sort of improvements to the society there. Amar Rav matbea tikein lehem ushmuel amar shvakim tikein lehem verbi yochanan amar merchatzaot. So either he established some form of currency, or he made marketplaces, or he made bathhouses. So Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai said, you see, if a miracle happens to you, you're supposed to try and contribute afterwards. What is he going to contribute? Amar, Ike Milta Debailit Kune, is there something that needs to be fixed? And people told him, yeah, there's a certain marketplace, or a certain place where there's Safik Tuma. It's not clear. We know that there are bodies buried in the area, but we don't know exactly where the bodies are. And therefore, Kohanim, who have to be careful not to walk through a place which is impure, have to be careful. They can't walk through this area because we don't know where the bodies are and where they aren't. And so it's a big problem for the Kohanim. So yeah, Ika Dochta De'it Be Safik Tuma. So there's a place where there's Safik Toma, the Kohanim have difficulty going there. Nafak Lashuka Chazi Lehuda. Fine. So eventually, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai fixes up the problem. He goes, it's not exactly clear what he does, either miraculously or he feels the ground and he sees where it's soft and where it's hard. Where it's hard, certainly they didn't dig it up and there's probably not a grave there. Where it's, he marks it out. One way or another, he fixes the marketplace or this area so that Kohanim can go through. In the end of the day, he sees Rabbi Yehuda ben or Yehuda ben Gerim and says, "Adayin yesh l'zeh be'olam? Are you still alive? You caused this whole problem." And then he zaps him with laser eyes and turns him into a pile of bones. Whatever exactly that means, he's alive after he's not alive, was not a good end for Yehuda ben Gerim. Okay, so we have this story. What do I want from this story? Many people quote this story and say, "Oh, you see, they just cut out the little snippet from Yaakov and say, oh, you see, Yaakov contributed to the society where he lived. He made bathhouses, he made currency for them, he made marketplaces for them, so it's good to contribute." But I think what might be going on here in the debate between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai is exactly the kind of question that we're asking. The historical context is that we're living under Roman rule. Romans have conquered Eretz Yisrael, and they've introduced all of these infrastructural things. They built marketplaces, they built bathhouses, they built bridges, and objectively, those things are useful. They improve the quality of life of people that live there. Now you have a bridge. Yes, they take taxes from the bridge, but you know, it's the free market principle. If you don't need the bridge, no one would use it, and they wouldn't get any taxes. So obviously, people feel like it's useful to go over the bridge. They have the marketplaces. Yes, they put prostitutes in the marketplace, whatever exactly the goal of that is, for money or for other reasons. But they put them there. But we have marketplaces now. They're useful. The bathhouses are also useful. All these things are useful. They improve the quality of life of the Jews who are living there. And the question is, pragmatically, this was a good thing. It was advantageous. But the value system, the value behind it, the goal of the Romans in introducing all these changes was not the betterment of society. It was for their own desire. They wanted to benefit. They made the bridges so they could become more wealthy. They made the bathhouses for their own officials, their own Romans that are living there so they can use them. They made the marketplaces to put whatever exactly the goal is there. The value, the goal behind enacting these changes was not pure, but the results of it were. So how do you relate to that? If I'm living in a society and the society does all kinds of great things to improve the quality of life, but they're for bad reasons. Morally, ethically, I don't agree with the values. They're selfish, the Romans. They wanted to do this for themselves. But practically, it works out. So Rabbi Yehuda says, you can say, it's not clear exactly if he's saying this because, you know, there's always the fear of the government around. You can say that these are nine, these people are great, look what they did. At the end of the day, they improved our quality of life. Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai says, no. We can't say that. Maybe pragmatically we can gain benefit, but to say these people are great, I, in our language that we're using, I identify with them. I feel like their values are my values. You can't say that because at the end of the day, they're not. They did all these things. They made all of these changes, but none of it was for a good reason. All of it was for selfish motivation. And so Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai says, you have to draw a line. I'm not going to say I identify. I'm not going to say I feel that I, you know, I'm going to laud these people and say how great they are if what they're doing is ultimately for bad reasons. And we see that Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai is justified at an ultimate level in the Gemara in Source 11, which is the story in Avodah Zarah where God is judging all of the... Yeah, question?
Yeah, I think the issue is not so much whether you justify the Romans or you don't. It seems to me that the real issue here is that when you speak publicly against the government, the word gets back to the government, and then you besmirch their reputation. So it demonstrates that it's not a good idea whether you feel that you can argue back and forth about whether it's good or not what the Romans did. But once you criticize publicly, because we're talking about how you relate to the government in right. The previous parts, here, the relationship with that government is broken because you have publicly shamed them or criticized them.
Right.
And that is what's at the heart of this story, because that ultimately comes back to bite you when you criticize the government, when that government is not a benevolent government.
Right, so that's true, and that might be part of Rabbi Yehuda's position. Why am I complimenting the... I mean, he also saw what was going on. Why is he complimenting? Because there's always a concern. But Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai seems to say, I don't care, I know that there's danger. And he ends up in serious danger. He has to run for his life. He's taken care of miraculously.
If you're going to criticize a non-benevolent government, then make sure that you do it in a discreet way.
Right, that's true. That's fair, yeah.
I thought it wasn't a public thing. It was an exchange between Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Yehuda, and then Rabbi Yehuda related that. So it wasn't a public shame.
That's true. Well, then you have to be careful about who you're talking to, you know, who you're talking to. I mean, it's... But I think that's the issue here. Besides Rabbi Shimon, the one who was who had to run away, wasn't he criticized later on because he also zapped somebody?
Right. So that's a whole separate part of the discussion. He came out and they were zapping people and they had to go back in.
Yeah, but he was criticized for that. He's a particularly harsh personality.
Right. There's a lot of zapping. But you're right. But I think overall, the story comes out to justify Rav Shmuel Bar Yochai. There's a question about pragmatically, how do we approach the government? You're right. But what I also see here is that at a fundamental level, at a philosophical level, Rav Shimon Bar Yochai is justified. He is taken care of miraculously for making these claims, and he does survive it, and he comes out on top. And we also have this, so you're right, there is a component here about thinking about how to approach the government, but I think there's also a more fundamental point about how do we feel about the government. Rav Shimon Bar Yochai refused to say a good word about the Roman government, you know, at a moral and ethical level, if at the, you know, at the bottom line, they're not doing things for moral and ethical reasons. Right. So we see that backed up a little bit in the source 11. This is the Gemara in Avodah Zarah, which we'll just discuss outside, because we'll have to get on to some of the other stuff. But here, God is judging all of the nations. He's judging the big powers, and the Romans come in, and he asks them, what did you do? What did you occupy yourselves with? You were in power. You were an empire. What did you do? And they said, oh, God, we made these marketplaces, and we made bathhouses, and we amassed all this gold and silver, and all of it was just so that we could, you know, improve the lives of Bnei Israel. That was the goal, improve the lives of the Jews. And God will say, no, that's not true at all. This wasn't altruistic. You were selfish. You made these countries, you made all of these things for your own selves, right? You made the bathhouses to enjoy them. You made the marketplaces to place profit. The same thing that Reb Shimon Bar Yochai, the same criticism that Reb Shimon Bar Yochai leveled, will be leveled by God ultimately at the end. That seems to justify, at least, that Reb Shimon Bar Yochai's perspective is the correct one. So what we get out of here is this. This is what it's sort of the inverse. Reb Shimon Bar Yochai says, if you have a government which is providing with all kinds of pragmatic benefit, but the morals, the values of the government are not things that you can get behind. You cannot say, I identify, I feel together, I feel love, I feel something for this government. But that implies that if that wasn't the case, if you really had a government which sought to do the best for all of its citizens, which sought to improve the lives of the citizens, of the people that live there, that could be something that we could get behind. That might be something that we'd be able to sink our teeth into. And that would create, beyond just saying pragmatically we have to pray for the government because we don't want to end up in a bad situation, beyond saying we have Hakara Tatova, we would be able to say if this government is set up so that it tries to do the best for everyone, that tries to create rules and laws which improve people's lives, it does things and it introduces things which improve people's lives, that could be something that a Jewish person can say, yes, I identify with that. I feel that my values align with that kind of way of running a society. You don't have to take it from me. We'll see this exact kind of language from Moshe Feinstein in a minute. So that's the possibility. That's the framework that I want to spell out philosophically. That, you know, patriotism, you know, people sometimes try and look at these different sources as kind of disparate presentations about patriotism. Some people are more restrained, some people are less restrained. I think really it has to do with the place that you live, the government that you live in. Are you living in a place where the values of the government are things that you can identify with? Or are you living in a place where you're taken care of, you live under some sort of rule, you have to have Hakara Tatova, you have to pray for them so that in your own best interest, but the values are not something that you can really relate to. So depending on where you live, you'll relate to that government differently. It's not automatic that a Jew is patriotic, but it depends on the kind of place that they live. So where does this come out in terms of in practice, in practical application? Where does it happen that we show our patriotism? If we live in a place, I mean, I can speak for myself again, where we feel like the values of the country, the goal of the country is to create good for all of its citizens, to make a good life for people, to benefit everybody so that everybody can have the best possible life or a good life. And we feel that that's something that's in line with our values. How do we, practically speaking, express our patriotism? One possibility is simply to be an honest, law-abiding citizen. And you might think that that's laughable, and that's obvious. Obviously, you have to follow the law. But you know, in practice, historically, in the rough and tumble of places where Jews have lived, where the government was not honest, and they would cheat you, and they would steal, and they would coerce, and so on, you know, halacha developed certain mechanisms of trying to level the playing field by being tricky, by, you know, there's discussion of gezel akum and tricking an akum and so on, all these different ways in which we could respond to try and level the playing field, bribing officials. These kind of practices were commonplace at a certain point in history because that's how you could interact with the government. They were coming from this place of being tricky, you had to come from the place of being tricky. So in a place where we, you know, where we recognize that the government is not doing that, they're being straight, and they're trying to treat us the best we can, and there's rule of law, honest rule of law, perhaps one way of expressing that we agree with this, that this is something that we value, is simply to be honest law-abiding citizens, to follow the law. And in fact, Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, I didn't put it on the sheet, argues that this might be the basis, this might be part of the way that we understand the notion of Dina de Malchuta Dina. The notion that the rule of law of the government is the law, that Jews have to follow it, is based on the assumption that the majority, the community, creates rules for the benefit of everyone that lives in the community. And if you don't, and you have to follow them. If you don't agree with one, you think, I don't like this rule, whatever, your opinion sort of gets canceled out in the face of the majority. The idea being that it's for the benefit of everyone. The notion that we have to follow the law could be based on this idea that the law inherently is trying to make us, is trying to create a better society for us. And one place where this was expressed strongly is here in Igrot Moshe, Rav Moshe Feinstein. I have a bunch of things from Rav Moshe Feinstein because he expresses things in an interesting way. He's talking here, we can just read the English about, I mean, even though there's a bad typo in it, about the idea of the prohibition of Torah institutions, of Mostot Torah, from taking more from the government than they deserve, than the government's conditions set out. With regards to the, and you just see here, I mean, just to preface this, the language that he uses is that America is a malchut shel chesed. It's a government of kindness, and the goal of the government is to do the best for all of its citizens. He used the language that we used before. And therefore, we must follow the law. We must follow it to the letter. With regards to the kindness of the government of the United States of America, which God in his great mercy for the remnants of the survivors of the Jews in all the countries of Europe and the remnants of the Gedolei Torah and their students brought us here, and we established Torah centers, both old from Europe and new as well. And because this government of kindness, whose aim, only aim, actually says Kol, only aim is the betterment of all the inhabitants of the country, has enacted several programs to help students in all schools in the country so that they can learn and grow in their studies, the Torah institutions also receive tremendous help for their students. Certainly, all the yeshiva heads, administrators, and students recognize all the good of the government and bless it for the peace of the country, or they daven for the peace of the country and to all those who stand at its head. But certainly we are prohibited by God, who prohibited us in his holy Torah, to refrain from taking more than what the conditions of the government dictate to give. Even if they can get more from certain clerks who want to be kind with them and give them a special dispensation. And all the more so, you know, if you can say there's more students in our school than there really are and somehow get away with it and get more money for that, that's also forbidden. And because aside from being prohibited as theft, there are also greater isurim of telling lies, of being deceitful, of chilul Hashem, of causing shame to the Torah and its students. There's absolutely no permission for this. And just as God hates theft, so too does God hate supporting the Torah and its students through theft. What you see clearly in Rav Moshe Feinstein is this idea. The government here is not trying to trick us. They're not out to oppress us. They're not out to hurt us. They're out to benefit us. They created these programs where they give us money to teach our students. That's great, and therefore we have to respond in kind. We have to be honest, law-abiding citizens, and it's terrible. It's theft to steal. It's theft to say that we have more students than we have, to try and find some way to work around the system and so on. And he's saying this is part of the worldview. And unfortunately, if you think the other kind of worldview is non-existent, the perspective that you live in a country and whatever you can manage to trick and cheat out of the system is legitimate, you just have to read the news. I'm not going to say any more than that. But this is part of the split, I think. Part of the idea of being patriotic, of showing that I value, I identify with the values of the country, is simply to abide by the law of the country openly and honestly. Okay, is there any more extreme level of involvement? beyond just being a law-abiding citizen. So I think there are. And we're going to look at some sources which detail increasingly extreme involvements in the country. Because obviously, if I feel that I identify with the country, if I feel that I agree with its values, then I want to be involved in the country, in its judicial system, in its legislature, maybe in its army. The question is how much involvement do we find precedent for? And there's a certain point when it becomes interesting in terms of the conflict between my own involvement and my sort of devotion or my relationship with other Jews. So in America, at least, Moshe Feinstein has said again that our fundamental responsibility of involvement in the country is to vote. We're citizens of the country. This is in Source 13. I couldn't find the original version of this letter, but apparently in 1984, Moshe Feinstein wrote a letter regarding voting in elections, and he says it's the same kind of idea. We reached America. We're in America. America takes good care of us. We have a basic responsibility, therefore, to be engaged citizens. And the basic level of being an engaged citizen is to vote. You have to vote and try to elect officials. This is the letter. Was it in English?
Yeah.
Oh, he wrote in English.
It was a New York State registration.
Oh, okay, fine. So this is the letter written by Moshe Feinstein. He says it's a fundamental responsibility because of the rights granted by the U.S. Constitution and the Bill of Rights, etc. And I don't think there's any difference between what happens in America in this regard and in Canada. We're members of the country. They grant us full rights. And part of our recognition, part of our saying, we recognize that we value this, we like this, we appreciate it, we want to be involved, is simply to vote. And that's a pretty low-cost kind of involvement. Yeah.
So apropos of low-cost involvement, I'm thinking about sort of where the rubber hits the road. The idea of being in the army, where you're placing yourself in a position of danger, and you're doing it for a system that is not a Jewish system. It may be a Parv system, it may be even a system of Chesed, but it's not a Jewish system. Do you have an obligation? And if you don't have an obligation, do you have permission? Is it permissible to place yourself in a situation of danger for that kind of goal?
Right. So this is, addressed here. We'll jump forward. I didn't bring it in full, but I sort of addressed it in source number 15. We'll jump forward and we'll jump back afterwards. That's the most extreme. Are you willing to make the ultimate sacrifice for your country that you live in to put your life on the line by joining the army? And, as you said, that's a problem just in itself. Am I ready to do this? I'm giving up my life, potentially. But there's also a further problem. What happens if you're on the battlefield as a Jewish Canadian soldier and you find yourself fighting a Jewish soldier from another country? Now, it's not only the fact that you put your life on the line, but it's also the fact that I have conflicting responsibilities. I have responsibility to this person as a Jew. I have responsibility to my country as a soldier of the country. And what do you do? So I'm not prepared to get into it in full. I think it's a complicated question. I know it's a complicated question. I'm not prepared to get to it in full. I brought one source in this regard in 15, which was from the Grand Sanhedrin of Napoleon. In 1807, Napoleon is freeing the Jews from the ghettos, he's emancipating them, and he has a bunch of questions for these Jews who are going to be now subjects in his new country, in his republic, and he wants to know where they stand on a bunch of issues, so he forms this Sanhedrin. He Dafka formed it on Shabbos, whatever. But he forms Sanhedrin, he asks them a bunch of different questions, and very difficult questions, and they have to answer exactly what is the Jewish position. So one of the questions was, this is in source 15, this is from the Wikipedia sort of short form, but do the Jews born in France and treated by the law as French citizens acknowledge France as their country? Are they bound to defend it? Are they bound to obey the laws and follow the directions of the civil code? Where do you stand in terms of being a Jew and fighting to defend the country? And the answer of the Sanhedrin was, the Israelite is required to consider the land of his birth or adoption as his fatherland, and shall love and defend it when called upon. And famously, they said, we are Frenchmen of the Mosaic persuasion. We're Frenchmen first, and we're also Jews. And therefore, they were ready to fight in the war, and this was the decision. And they did. It became historically largely dramatic and tragic in World War I, which is where this really came to head. You had German soldiers who were Jews. You had French soldiers, British soldiers who were Jews, Russian soldiers who were Jews, and they were fighting each other. And there's accounts of people, one person, is stabbing the other with his bayonet, and he hears the person that's dying cry out, Shema Yisrael, and he realizes he just killed another Jewish soldier. So this is a real concern. It really happened. The question of whether you should do this or not, I'm going to leave in the open. But this is the extreme. The extreme level of involvement is, should you or can you go to join the army of the country in which you live, given that it's going to put you, A, in a position to do things, to put your life on the line for the country, and B, in a conflict in terms of your dedication to other Jews. Okay, in terms of slightly less intense involvement, but nonetheless interesting, we have the story in the Gemara in Bava Metzia, here, which is in source number 14. And here we're talking about police work. Rabbi Lazar, son of Rabbi Shimon, who is, I believe, the son of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, I think that is the Rabbi Lazar of Rabbi Shimon, he encountered a certain officer of the, this is still the Roman government, whose responsibility was to arrest thieves. And he said to the officer, how are you doing this? How do you know who's guilty and who's not? You're just arresting people left, right, and center. Isn't it complicated to figure out who to arrest? So the officer said, yeah, but what am I supposed to, I'm just short summarizing it, but the officer said, yeah, but what am I supposed to do? This is my job. It's Hermana de Malka. The government decree is you have to catch thieves and execute them, whatever, or punish them, however you're going to punish them. So Rabbi Elazar Reb Shimon said, I'll give you some good advice. Go into the tavern in the fourth hour of the day. And if you see someone drinking wine who's exhausted in the fourth hour of the day, still early in the day, you should ask him, what does he do for a living? If he says that he's a Talmud Chacham, he's a Torah scholar, then he's probably tired because he got up really early in the morning to learn, and that's why he's tired at this time of the day. If he does work that happens at night, then he's probably tired because he was working all night. If he's a daytime laborer, somebody who's a Schir Yom, then he probably woke up at the crack of dawn to work before the day got, whatever, he had to work early in the morning. But if he's none of those things, then who else is up in the night and is going to be exhausted during the day? Probably a thief. So then he's a thief and you should arrest him. And they found that this was a very effective way of catching thieves. Great. So in the end, the government said, oh, well, Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Shimon, if you're so good at this, you become the detective. You can become the guy who goes and arrests thieves. So he's arresting all of these thieves. And eventually, Rabbi Shua ben Korcha sends him a message and says, this is not appropriate because there are Jews here. You're catching Jews and giving them over to the government and they're being killed. They're being executed. So Rabbi Shua ben Korcha sends him a letter. You're a vinegar son of wine, which is not a compliment. You know, it's a bad thing. Your father was wine. You are vinegar. You're sending off the people of our, you know, members of our nation to be killed, to be executed. Rabbi Elazar Rabbi Shimon said, I'm not doing anything bad. I'm just removing the thorns and the thistles from the garden. These are not good people. I'm not sending a good Erlich Yid to go and be killed. These are thieves, so what's the problem? And Rav Shua ben Korcha said, let the owner of the vineyard come and take the thorns out himself. God will do it. You don't have to do this. So this is a debate. It's not clear how it's settled. This actually becomes an important source in the discussion of the balance between the prohibition of Mesira, of giving over somebody to the government for inappropriate reasons for punishment, and legitimate cases where you can give someone over to the government. In terms of child abuse, it becomes a big discussion, and that whole area of halacha. But what we see here is, again, the reason why, just in terms of the ethical standpoint, the reason why Rabbi Elazar Rabbi Shimon is doing this is because he recognizes the value of putting thieves into jail. He sees the government wants to put the thieves into jail. He wouldn't do this if the government program was find religious Jews that are very good, nice people and put them in jail. He wouldn't help them to do that. He's doing this because he recognizes the value. And here there's a conflict between his, you know, dedication as a Jew and his dedication to the country, because the halacha does not prescribe death for thieves, right? Halacha has all kinds of punishment, depends how you did it and what you did, but it certainly doesn't prescribe death. So here you see Rabbi Elazar Rabbi Shimon involving himself on the basis that he feels some sort of sense of identification with the value of catching thieves, even though it's going to come into conflict with his, with halacha. It's coming into conflict with his, you know, responsibility to other Jews. And that's exactly what Rabbi Shua ben Korcha calls him out on. How can you do this? You're sending Jews over to die. And he says, what do you mean? This is an he responds with an ethical argument. This is a good thing. I'm not doing a bad thing. Look, the Romans want to get rid of the thieves. I'm removing thorns from the garden. So this is a little bit of a more intensive level of involvement. It certainly more has more cost than voting. You're involved as a policeman. Today, I mean, we have people that are involved in all kinds of levels, in the judicial system, and in politics, as policemen. There's all kinds of Jews who are involved in society, and presumably it's based partially on this. This is another way of expressing patriotism. If I recognize the values of the country and identify with them, then I'm going to get involved, even if sometimes it comes into conflict with my responsibility towards other Jews. That could happen. Okay, a final area of involvement in the inner sancta, in our religious lives, can Jews, this is what's here in source number 16, can you bring a flag of the country into shul? Can you or should you bring a flag of the country, of the state of Israel, of the state that you live in, into shul? So somebody actually asked Rav Moshe. The reason why they asked him was as a point of argument. There was some shul where they brought flags into the sanctuary of the shul, and people in the shul therefore wanted to split off and make a new minyan and not daven there because they didn't want to daven there because there are flags in the shul. So they asked Rav Moshe Feinstein, is this appropriate? Is this something, you know, is this a real substantial claim or not? And Rav Moshe said, I have it for you in 16. The American flag is being put into the shul. It's not being put there because they want to worship the American flag. The flag of the state of Israel is not being put there because they want to worship it. It's not something of Kedusha. That's not the goal. And he says, why would someone put this into the shul? The American flag, which also proves that they did not bring it in because they consider it a holy object, but rather is an indication on the part of the leader of the synagogue that they love this country and the state of Israel and want to demonstrate this in a public place. Therefore, even though it is certainly inappropriate, he doesn't like it. He doesn't think you should bring flags into shul. To bring flags into a shul, which is a place of holiness, and all the more so, they should not be left there permanently, and all the more so next to the Ark, next to the Aron, but there is no concrete prohibition. Rather, it is a matter of vanity and foolishness, and if it is possible in a peaceful way to remove them from the synagogue, this would be a good thing, but to make an argument out of this is forbidden, and he says the people that are making this into an issue are just doing this because of politics, and it's a disaster, and it's because of Gullus, and so on. But the point that I wanted to make out here is, he says, even to bring flags into the shul, not for, you know, some sort of wayward religious practice, because I just want to show my appreciation for the state of Israel in shul, he thinks that's inappropriate. That's not a good idea. This is one example. Another example, which I didn't put on the sheet, and we'll mention very briefly outside, A, because we're in the wrong country to talk about it, and B, because I thought the sheets were long enough, is the issue of Thanksgiving. Rav Moshe has a lot of tshuvas about Thanksgiving. Should you celebrate Thanksgiving? Should you celebrate national holidays? And how should you celebrate them? So he waffles. It's not clear. He has one tshuva where he seems to say it's a problem. He has another tshuva where he seems to say it's okay. He has a third tshuva where his grandson called him out and said, I read your tshuvas. One of them says one thing, the other says the other thing. What do you really think? And so he deals with it. And his concern there is about the issue of Chukat Akum. Are we doing this holiday because it has real purpose? Are we doing this holiday because we're following in the ways of the non-Jews? And his concern, his doubt, is whether if I'm doing a holiday for absolutely no purpose, for very little purpose, is that really considered something legitimate in Jewish practice or not? I don't really want to get into the fine details, A, because Thanksgiving in Canada does not involve a lot, and B, because we're running out of time. But he hesitates. He's not ready to say you should do that. I'm not sure exactly what it would say about the 4th of July or Canada Day, but we're talking about this at breakfast. It's not entirely clear what you're supposed to do on the 4th of July or Canada Day. Fireworks. We had a cake in shul this week. Someone brought a cake into shul, which said happy 150th Canada and had a big Canadian flag. So that maybe that's what you do on Canada Day. I don't know. But he certainly hesitates. Why this hesitance?
Was the writing happy birthday, was it on a cookie or was it on the cake?
It was on the cake.
Was it in English and French?
No, it was just in English. So that, aside from, whatever, I don't want to get involved in how big was the French writing. It was non-existent because it wasn't there. Not going there. But he hesitates. You see, when we start to talk about changing our holiday structure, when we start to talk, even when Rav Moshe says Thanksgiving is okay, he says you absolutely can establish it as a requirement, as a thing every year. I didn't realize how seriously Americans took Thanksgiving until I went to yeshiva and I was in Israel and we had Thanksgiving lunch with turkey and cranberry sauce and everything. And then I realized this is serious because if you're going to do it in outside of America. So anyway, but the point is why does he falter? And this is, I think, a point that I have to make just because I would be remiss otherwise, is that when it comes to engagement in the public square, in terms of making the country better place, in terms of providing services for citizens and so on, in terms of the police force, in terms of the judicial system, in terms of politics, for sure, there is lots to contribute there. But when it comes to our relationship with God, when it comes to the inner sanctum of Jewish life, in shul, in our holidays, then Rav Moshe is not so ready to say that we're really proud and we want to be patriotic in those spheres. Those spheres may be personal. And this is expressed nicely. I couldn't find the best way. I wonder if it's written up somewhere. I've heard recordings. But this is an idea which is expressed by Rabbi Soloveitchik in a bunch of different places. He describes Avraham Avinu's description, statement, to Bnei Chet when he's buying the plot of land to bury Sarah. He says, Ger v'toshav anochi imachem. I am a sojourner, but I'm also a permanent resident. I'm a stranger here, but I also live here. So Rabbi Soloveitchik says, this reflects a kind of dual tension. On the one hand, we're ready to contribute. The patriotic Jew, if you will, who recognizes the values of the country, is ready to contribute in terms of making the country better for everybody. That's something that we're interested in. On the other hand, at a certain level, in the terms of our relationship with God, in terms of our religious lives, there's a recoil. At a certain level, we're also strangers. And therefore, to say that, you know, we're going to bring a flag into shul, to say we're going to change the calendar year of our Yom Tovim, things like that, which reflect our deep relationship with God, that's something which may be private. And therefore, there may be room for that too. So just to sum up, we found that perhaps patriotism may express itself differently depending on what the country that a Jew finds himself in. It may express itself simply as a recognition of the importance of having government at a practical level. It may express itself in terms of my gratitude for what the government does for me, but without a reflection, without a feeling of identification or value. And then if we live in a place which really seeks to do the best for all of its citizens, there may be a place for feeling identity, for feeling that I realize the values here, and for acting in terms of voting, in terms of being involved in the various systems of the government, in terms of being an honest, law-abiding citizen. And we have to consider, I mean, we didn't deal with this in depth, we have to consider where exactly the point of recoil is when our personal religious lives, when our communal religious lives, in terms of our relationship with God, sort of comes into the picture here, where exactly is the line where we say, no, this is private, this is for Bnei Yisrael and the relationship with the Kadosh Baruch Hu, and this is not part of our involvement in the rest of the country. Okay, thanks again for coming. Happy